Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us.
Trains and boats and planes are passing by. They mean a trip to Paris or Rome or someone else.
But two things in trouble that we really need to be working and working well: our infrastructure, roads, bridges, airports, drinking water, solid waste, parks, schools. It's a long list of structures and systems that we rely on, and supply chains, especially those that move things like medical supplies to hospitals that are on the front lines of COVID-19. On the infrastructure front, Texas stands as an example of failing systems after the recent winter storm left millions of people in desperate need of water and electricity. And it was happening even as NASA was sticking a rover landing on Mars. Now, if you've had difficulty squaring those two things, you're not alone. Well, what does all this look like from the perspective of a civil engineer, one who does the work of designing and building infrastructure? We're about to find out. Tom Smith, Executive Director of the American Society of Civil Engineers, himself a civil engineer, joins us from Reston, Virginia. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Tom.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Your organization produces a report card on America's infrastructure. What's America's grade point average?
And the overall grade point average is a C-, so certainly not something to be proud of. However, I will mention that this is the first time we've been doing this since 1998. We do it every 4 years. This is the first time we've been out of the D range. So we have had some incremental improvement, very small improvement, moving from a D-plus to a C-, but not something to be proud of. It's 17 categories of infrastructure that we look at, and 11 of those categories are still in the D range. Four of them are in the C range. Two of them are in the B range. So while we've moved to a C-, there's an enormous amount of work to do. It's mediocre, sort of at best, and still has increasing vulnerability to risk.
Bringing it closer to home, the report notes at greatest risk here in Kentucky are dams, levees, and roads, all getting a D+. In real terms, what does that mean for those structures?
Yeah, we also, in addition to our national report card, do the state-level report card. So this is the 2019 Kentucky report card. And yes, as you mentioned, you know, the dams were at a D+, obviously a critical part of Kentucky's infrastructure. Many citizens enjoy the benefits that the dams provide. But what we're finding is just an increasing amount of maintenance backlog on so many of these things that are in the D range that we have just failed to invest in them over time. And many of these, much of our infrastructure will go back 50, 75, sometimes 100 years old. And so you think, you know, we were able to do some of these things back during the Depression, right about, you know, some of those times and some of the amazing things that took place even then. But we're failing to even maintain it, much less really modernize it and really prepare ourselves for the future. At the same time, we're also seeing increasingly severe storms. Of course, you're seeing that in rainfalls. So you've seen that in Kentucky, where we've added also more impervious surface, more people. So we've got to, you know, be more resilient with our infrastructure and also be more sustainable, make sure we're considering the environment and future generations.
Well, I notice you've added a new category, stormwater, and I assume that's a response to what we're seeing happen with climate change and so forth.
Yeah, stormwater is an increasing concern. As I mentioned, with these impervious surfaces that we're adding, we've got exacerbating, you know, urban flooding, which is about $9 billion in damages annually. And again, you know, Kentucky's seeing that now. Mm-hmm. But there's 600,000 miles of rivers and streams and more than 13 million acres of lakes and reservoirs and ponds that are considered impaired right now in the United States. I'm also, you know, pretty passionate about our combined sewer overflow. You know, we've got that here in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. We're working on it. Lots of consent decrees where you have stormwater and sanitary, you know, your wastewater. So the water coming off the roof of your house, as well as the water when you're flushing your toilets, using some of the same pipes. And when we have heavy rainfall, sometimes that has to then discharge into our rivers. And that can be, you know, also something I don't think we should tolerate. I don't think we should tolerate that you can't swim in rivers in, you know, next to your big cities.
Oh, we're way too familiar with it here in Lexington, Kentucky. We're under an $800 million EPA consent decree. It's been going on for many years now, and we're toward the end of the mitigation, and it's been really interesting to see how that infrastructure has come about. It's been pretty incredible. But we had that same experience with sanitary and stormwater sewers mingling in major storms. Tom, is the aging and, in a lot of cases, fragile state of our infrastructure, is this due to a general decline in investment or something else?
Yes. I mean, there's certainly investment is a huge part of it. And we have identified in our report card that the cost, you know, nationwide, we're talking about $2.59 trillion over 10 years. That is the funding gap for the 17 different categories of infrastructure. And by the way, that's considering, you know, aviation, bridges, dams, drinking water, energy, hazardous waste, inland waterways, levees, ports, public parks, rail, roads, schools, solid waste, stormwater, transit, and wastewater. So it is a big ticket. And about half of that is on surface transportation. That's funding, by the way, from the federal, state, and local level. So while it does require significant investment, I think one other thing to keep in mind is that we're also paying a tax today by failing to invest in infrastructure. You know, our economic studies show every family's paying about $3,300 a year because we have not invested in infrastructure. And you can think about, you know, whether the time you sit in traffic or hitting a pothole or power outages or water main breaks, all these things add to the cost of goods and services, inefficiencies in the system that are passed on to the consumer. So while we're paying a tax today, you know, and getting absolutely nothing for it, we should be investing in our infrastructure so that we can create jobs, be globally competitive. We could actually improve our environment, address some of the concerns that we have, clean water, clean air. And even you hear discussions, you know, also about social equity and making sure that we have equal opportunities and engage for not just water, but transportation so people can get to jobs. And so there's just every reason to be doing this. You know, it impacts rural as well as urban communities. It impacts red as well as blue states. You know, we always say it's a red, white, and blue issue. And so I'm hearing a great deal of optimism. Now, I have to tell you, this is not the first administration we've had this discussion with. I can tell you with the Trump administration, the Obama administration, and the Bush administration, we had lots of discussions about infrastructure. But I think the need is getting more, especially as we watch other countries jumping ahead. You know, there are tens of thousands of miles of high-speed rail throughout Europe and Asia, and you know, we're no longer in the top 10 out of the World Economic Forum infrastructure, you know, listings by country. So we're seeing ourselves fall behind in terms of global competitiveness as well. So there's every reason to be doing this.
Well, it does seem that infrastructure is among the short list of priorities of the Biden administration. We know we're going to get some form of new federal funding for infrastructure. If you were to prioritize, what would you say are our most pressing needs right now?
Well, it's there's certainly the largest piece of the funding gap is surface transportation. But, you know, just looking at the there's so many infrastructure categories in the D range that they all have a certain importance. So it's hard to say, you know, that energy, even though energy, by the way, got moved from a D plus to a C minus for a variety of reasons. But it's hard to, you know, to say that you would take a, you know, how do you prioritize something over energy versus drinking water versus bridges versus stormwater versus wastewater? I mean, these things are also important. But certainly the lowest grade in our report card, transit is a D minus, and schools also. Actually, I'm sorry, schools is at a D plus. So
still not great.
Yep, still not great. And stormwater is at a D. So, you know, there's a lot of categories that are in great need of attention. As you mentioned, that's, we're optimistic because right now the Congress is focusing on the COVID rescue and relief. But second in line, we think, would be infrastructure. Pete Buttigieg, the Secretary of the Department of Transportation, both he and President Biden, where we hosted a presidential forum back in January, they both showed up with very concrete solutions and ideas on infrastructure. So they both are very passionate from what we have seen. But as you said, you know, of course, delivering is another thing, and, and making sure we get the pay for it is where it always stumbles in the past.
Well, while the goal of addressing infrastructure seems bipartisan, everybody's for it, the details are not, including how much to spend, what programs count as infrastructure, and maybe most important, whether to raise taxes to pay for it. In your work as an advocate for civil engineering, what's your read on what's most likely to emerge from Congress? Do you think there can be some sort of consensus around this?
I do. I think there can be. You know, of course, we've advocated for an increase in the gas tax in the past. That's not popular amongst the, you know, both sides of the aisle. It hasn't been increased since 1993. It is not a very good long-term solution, especially if you see more things going to electric vehicles and high efficiency vehicles. But in the short term, it's a good solution. In the meantime, 37 states over the last 10 years have increased their gas tax. So the states are taking action. And we're seeing, I think it was 98% of infrastructure ballot initiatives passed in November. So the states are certainly taking some initiative here, but I do think we need some, you know, national vision, national leadership, mobilizing, inspiring the country behind this, putting people back to work, building our country. There's just every reason to do it. And there's a variety of different ways you pay for it. It certainly requires national, state, and local investment, and it does also require private. I mean, the public-private partnerships are an option. But we do have to recognize that all of us use infrastructure, and we have to be prepared to pay for infrastructure. You know, we shouldn't balk at the, you know, paying our water bill and our electricity bill when we, you know, when we compare it to what we're paying for whatever, coffee or entertainment. This has got to be the absolute top priority because it is, it's our quality of life, and it's what we depend on for life itself. And we really recognize that when we don't have it. When you don't have power and you don't have drinking water, as many people have been going through, it's very, very difficult, and you appreciate it. It's at the very top of your list.
Most state tax collections did plunge last spring at the outset of the pandemic when shutdown orders started and millions were thrown out of work, businesses closed, and there were worries expressed all over the place that we're facing a replay of the Great Recession. But this time, after falling initially, those tax collections turned back up again, all in the span of just a few months. So, in your mind, does that strengthen the argument on the state level for investing tax dollars in infrastructure improvement?
I think so. And the there is also the issue that there is still some suffering out there. You know, look at transit, look at airports. I mean, so the state and local governments have really felt an impact in trying to fund some of the transportation networks that they relied on that were, you know, sort of user fee based. But the fact that, yes, state and local governments recognize they don't have a, there's no choice. We have to invest in infrastructure. You couldn't run a business without having a, you know, computer network, and you wouldn't do it with a rotary dial phone anymore, even though it works. It wouldn't make you competitive. And I think most state and local governments are recognize that they absolutely need that because it helps to drive their own economies, which helps to drive the tax base and helps to attract people and retain people. So, you know, there's every reason to be investing in it. We just need to do it.
Well, we often do hear that a big boost in infrastructure spending can stimulate the economy, including creating a lot of jobs, a lot of good jobs. And that might seem obvious, but in real terms, what does that look like?
Yeah, the AFL-CIO was just on this on a panel discussion today. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is always involved in these discussions, so it's one of the few times that you can get big business and big labor together, and they agree on something because it does create good-paying jobs, and it does helps business. It spurs the economy. I mean, one of the economic studies that we did that where we referenced that that when you fail to invest, you have this hidden tax that we pay. But it also at the macro level, if current investment trends continue, we could lose the nation's economy over the next two decades. It was shown that $10 trillion in gross domestic product, 3 million jobs, $23 trillion in business productivity. That's how important our infrastructure is at the macro level as you look out over the next couple of decades. So there's a lot at stake here in terms of jobs, in terms of our gross domestic product. And especially, again, as you watch what other countries are doing and compare their infrastructure to ours, there's every reason to do this.
What sorts of innovations and emerging technologies might make important differences in any effort to upgrade our infrastructure?
Yeah, you know, we just talked about combined sewer overflow. I mean, one of the things we're really focusing on is making sure we're harmonizing with the natural environment and using natural processes as well. So even to address something like combined sewer overflow, we're building a fair number of tunnels, and we've got a couple that are going on in the DC area, and I know the city of Alexandria here is planning one. But also pushing this, green infrastructure. So right here, we just redid our parking lot at ASCE. We put in a couple of bioretention facilities. We put in precast concrete permeable pavers, and we also put in permeable interlocking pavers. We put in new asphalt that's mixed with crumbled tires that increases the lifespan of the asphalt. So while that is impermeable, use recycled over 700 tires just in our parking lot here. This is just one example on a very small scale, but there are large projects all over the country that are doing exciting things. I mean, in Seattle, they put in the SR 99 tunnel, the Alaskan Way Viaduct, and that's one of the things that will help to address issues that they had with an elevated roadway there before, especially as concerned about seismic. There's an enormous amount of innovation out there. I mean, the Bayonne Bridge that was raised in New York, New Jersey, to allow the post-Panamax ships to go underneath it. It was just a very innovative project, and it will help to address issues like climate change and rising sea levels in the future. So we do have to consider those issues as well with our design so that we're more resilient.
Well, all of this is going to be fascinating and interesting to follow. And I wonder if after whatever legislation makes it through Congress emerges and we see what's going to be done, if we could come back to you and get your reaction to it.
Oh, absolutely. Would love to. Love to talk with you anytime. And I really appreciate your covering this issue and appreciate your listeners. If they have any questions, they can go to asce.org or infrastructurereportcard.org and see our 2021 report card. We've got a lot of background information on the report cards on each of these 17 categories as well, if anybody wants to read up on any topic. And also you can link from there to the Kentucky report card and get additional information on those categories as well.
All right. That's Tom Smith, Executive Director of the American Society of Civil Engineers. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom. Have a great day.
Trains and boats and planes are passing by. They mean a trip to Paris or Rome for someone else, but not for me. The trains and and planes took you away, away from me.
One example of infrastructure investment that pays dividends but may not be quite as obvious as airports, seaports, or train depots will soon materialize on the University of Kentucky's Coldstream Research Campus along Newtown Pike in Lexington. I put in a call to Coldstream's executive director, George Ward. Welcome to Eastern Standard.
Tom, thank you. It's great to be talking to you.
And tell us about this new building that'll soon come up on the Coldstream campus.
We are building a 40,000 square foot building. It'll be two stories, and it'll be a combination of office space and laboratory space. And it's designed for early stage companies that are in a growth mode but aren't quite ready to stand on their own 2 feet financially yet. So half of the building is going to be master leased by Kentucky Technology, Inc., which is a for-profit company owned by UK's Research Foundation. And as a dual role, I serve as its president. And so our plan is to sublease space to, these growing companies. The building will be called the CORE, which stands for Collaboration, Research, and Entrepreneurship.
This has been made possible by a partnership, as I understand it, between UK, the Woodbury Corporation, and state and local governments. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And how is the Woodbury Corporation involved?
We did a request for proposal for a public-private partnership. And the respondents were made aware that they would be at risk for the building. However, Kentucky Technology, Inc. coming in with half of the building master leased gave them a great anchor tenant. So they were able to take the risk on building the remainder of the building.
When do you anticipate the opening will be?
Sometime in February or March of 2022, we should be ready to open.
All right. George Ward, Executive Director at the University of Kentucky's Coldstream Research Campus. Thank you, George.
You're welcome, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Also at a breaking point, supply chains. President Biden has ordered a 100-day government review to look for potential weak links in U.S. supply chains for critical items such as computer chips, medical gear, electric vehicle batteries, and specialized minerals. Joining us from the Gatton College of Business and Economics at the University of Kentucky is Yunki Mai, an assistant professor who focuses on supply chain management. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Mai.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me here, Tom.
And when you heard that this review had been ordered, what were some of the first things that came to mind?
The first word that came to my mind was finally. So my colleagues and I have been waiting for this move since the beginning of the pandemic, which is necessary given all the supply chain disruptions we experience. And it has been a very important lesson that we need to build integrated and independent supply chains for critical items to make them less vulnerable to unexpected disruptions.
So I named a few there, but which critical supply chains would you say are the most vulnerable right now?
I think the most vulnerable are supply chains related to high-tech industry, because high-tech companies are the ones who benefit from globalization the most, and therefore rely on overseas suppliers the most. And I believe this is why the executive order particularly listed items such as computer chips and electric vehicle batteries.
We've heard that there's a global computer chip shortage, which is an increasingly dire problem for manufacturers. Where in the chain is the problem?
The problem is in tier one suppliers. So most semiconductor companies nowadays, like AMD or Intel, they only design chips. And for the manufacturing part, they just outsource to tier one suppliers. And there are only two major tier one suppliers, TSMC in Taiwan and Samsung in South Korea. And they are already producing as fast as they can, but it's still not enough to meet the increasing demand of consumer electronics, mostly due to people having to work from home during the pandemic. So the shortage is caused by the increasing need on the demand side and not enough capacity on the supply side, given the best practice has been outsourcing.
Tell us about Kentucky's role in meeting the distribution and logistics challenges related to COVID-19 and to meeting this new demand for a supply chain renovation.
Sure. So Kentucky has been playing a very important role because of our ideal location. So we are actually within a day's drive of 65% of the U.S. population. And for that reason, Kentucky is one of the most important logistics hubs. So UPS, DHL, and Amazon, they all have large shipping centers in Kentucky to fulfill delivery needs across the entire country. And the current pandemic only signifies the importance of Kentucky. So for example, UPS shipping center in Louisville has been the most important DC for COVID vaccines. And I think in the long run, with the executive order to build independent supply chains, a decent amount of new jobs will be created for Kentuckians.
How would you say the impact of the pandemic has changed the best practices for supply chain management?
So essentially, before the pandemic, everyone in the supply chain industry was talking about lean operations, outsourcing, or offshoring. And all of them are mostly for cost reduction. But after the pandemic, people have realized we probably went too far for cost reduction. It's important to reduce costs, but it's also important to manage supply risk properly. And now it's time for every company to re-examine and reevaluate their sourcing strategies, shifting their focus from almost purely cost reduction to a mix of cost reduction and supply risk management.
The president's order also set in motion much longer-term studies beyond the 100 days of supply needs of the defense, public health, information technology, transportation, energy, and food production sectors. What sorts of issues do you expect they will identify?
In general, I believe they will find the issues to be way more complicated than they expected. So after decades of globalization, changes cannot happen overnight. And many manufacturing jobs have left the States for a long time, and reestablishing those supply chains could be difficult, if not impossible. So identifying the issues could be non-trivial itself, but addressing the issues could be the real problem. And it may take them a lot of even longer-term efforts in order to address them.
It seems that what we're hearing from the White House is a primary interest in domestic supply chains, but the president did say that this is not about reshoring all supply chains to America. Why is that an important distinction?
That could be a very important distinction to emphasize, because there will be resistance from major companies if the order will be perceived as forcing them to reshore all supply chains. So going too far for globalization creates problems, but going too far for deglobalization is not going to be ideal either. So I think companies and the government should work together to strike a balance between the two, finding the sweet spot so that they can get the best of both worlds.
And we also hear that American companies that produce critical goods and materials will be required to develop contingency plans for addressing supply chain risks. Is that something new? Have no such plans existed in the past?
So contingency plans are not new. But what's new is requiring or mandating such contingency plans.
Mm-hmm.
So most companies will agree that they need contingency plans, but developing truly viable plans that can be implemented when necessary would take a lot of administrative efforts. So the last time we had a pandemic that is comparable to the current one was the Spanish flu, and that was 100 years ago. So we wouldn't expect companies to always be prepared for something that happens once every 100 years or even less often. But we do not know when the next disruption will be and what it will be. And in today's fast-evolving world, the only thing that's certain is uncertainty. So putting in systematic efforts by the government to mandate contingency plans that deal with uncertainties is a necessary move, I believe.
Well, it seems with the evolution of technology being as rapid as it is that it would follow that contingency planning would also have to continually evolve.
Yes, exactly.
As somebody who focuses his time and energies on supply chains, what current trends are interesting to you?
So going back to your earlier comments, that will be the adoption of disruptive technologies and innovations mm-hmm. in our today's fast-evolving world, which is accelerated by the current pandemic. So on a higher level, the executive order is also for securing U.S. leadership position in the ongoing technology race. So many people have predicted that we are on the verge of the next industrial revolution. So from 3D printing, blockchain, to smart automation enabled by machine learning technologies. I'm very curious to see how the adoption of these technologies will change the way people manage supply chains. And on an even broader scale, I'm also curious to see how it will change the life of every person on this planet.
That's Yuki Mai, an assistant professor at the Gatton College of Business and Economics at the University of Kentucky. Thank you, Dr. Mai.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
Coming up after the break.
For a long time, you know, bourbon has a history of being your grandfather's drink. You know, when we talk about being your grandfather's drink, it's really referred to as, you know, a white male's drink.
Diversity, inclusion, and equity in the bourbon industry. And the origins of the distance learning so familiar today. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Wendy Barnett with the Under Main Arts Minute, bringing you local and regional arts news and events. Want to combine your love of both nature and art? On March 19th from 10 a.m. to noon, the Josephine Sculpture Park in Frankfort will hold its March Volunteer Day in collaboration with the Woods and Waters Land Trust. Volunteers will work on removing invasive species in the park, which will encourage more plant diversity and improve the habitat for animals, human and otherwise. For more information about the event and to sign up to volunteer, go to the upcoming events page at josephinesculpturepark.org. For the best of writing about Kentucky arts, go to Undermain at under-main.com. This has been the Undermain Arts Minute for WEKU's Eastern Standard. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
The James B. Beam Institute at UK opened its second annual Bourbon Industry Conference on the 10th of March with speakers covering a wide range of issues and topics related to the making and marketing of Kentucky's signature libation. And we're going to focus on one of them right now. Gaethan Borden, Vice President, Marketing at Visit Lex, is on a four-person panel discussing diversity, equity, and inclusion in the bourbon industry. Gaethan, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Hey, Tom, thank you for having me. Glad to be here today.
And you're on this panel with Chelsea Nichols from Michter's Distillery, Hannah Lowen, New Rift Distilling, and Andrea Merriweather from Barfair Concepts. And first, if you would, tell us a little bit about your presentation.
Yeah, so what we're going to be talking about is just the diversity and the equity and the inclusion of bourbon in the trying to get people involved in the bourbon industry that goes beyond just males, talking about African Americans, talking about the contribution of women, and really talking about how for a long time, you know, bourbon has a history of being your grandfather's drink. You know, when we talk about being your grandfather's drink, it's really referred to as, you know, a white male's drink. And the marketing has been heavily catered to white males. And so we're going to be talking about, you know, new groups, new demographics that are doing bourbon consumption, talking about the history that's been erased from bourbon, primarily around African-American history, and then just diving into how we can make sure that the industry as a whole can grow and be more diverse in its offering.
Last June, as the demonstrations against racism, injustice, police brutality were breaking out all across the country, the Black Bourbon Society published an open letter to the bourbon and American whiskey industry. It was titled, We Insist, and it called for tangible action to address issues of racial stereotypes and biases, lack of diversity and inclusion, and insisted on the implementation of permanent programs that foster more inclusive and diverse environments within the industry's organizational structures and marketing practices. How has the industry responded? Is this panel discussion an indication of that?
It is. The Kentucky Distillers Association has taken a lead role in that issue. They have created a diversity, equity, and inclusion committee, which I'm proud to be a serving member of that committee. We've had several phone calls and meetings discussing what the Kentucky Distillers Association does currently right now in terms of addressing the systemic racism that exists in the bourbon industry and how they can help shed a light and kind of help move the needle and change the messaging going forward. Obviously, with them being a trade association, they have a lot of connections and conversations and relationships with all of the bourbon distillers, mainly in Kentucky, obviously, but across the country. And so having them on board to kind of help lead this charge and lead this message is where the industry has started. And you're starting to see some other spirits organizations start to adopt their diversity principles. I believe Beam Suntory just hired Victoria Russell as their global director of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think it's the first time they've ever had that position at Beam Suntory. So you're going to start seeing a lot of changes happening within the industry that everybody's excited about.
What are the key issues that need to be recognized and addressed in a very practical sense? And that was what you just cited was an example of addressing the issue, but expand on that if you would.
Yeah, I think one of the key issues really is, you know, we have to restore the history of, you know, African Americans in the bourbon industry in order to continue to bring them in as consumers. And, you know, one of the things that if you look at the history of distilling and whiskey making, primarily slaves were helping distilling all whiskey. But, you know, none of that history was written down and it's all quite honestly, it's all been erased. And so here in Kentucky specifically, the best history that we have in terms of African Americans goes back to Freddie Johnson, who's a Buffalo Trace. He's a third generation employee at Buffalo Trace and currently is the VIP visitor lead there. He's in the Kentucky Bourbon Hall of Fame, but his grandfather worked at Buffalo Trace with Colonel Blanton. His father worked at Buffalo Trace with Elmer T. Lee. And so one of the things that we want to make sure is that we recognize the contributions of where we've come from, and then that'll help us kind of go forward from where to moving the industry forward, knowing where we come from, and then that'll help us move forward. So understanding the history is going to be one of the key things for us.
There's a bit of history out there that is beginning to percolate that's really interesting. It's the unearthing of the legacy of Nathan Nearest Green, an African-American slave who taught Jack Daniel how to make whiskey. And it kind of it indicates what you're talking about. There's a lot more to this story, isn't there?
There is. If anybody's ever looked at historical images from distilleries, what you'll always see is you'll see a group of Black men that are in the back, and then you'll see a group of white men in the front. And what we've seen is that the black men in the back were the slaves who were actually doing the work and were teaching people how to distill whiskey, and the white men were in front. And so Nearest Green is actually the only factual proven documentation currently right now that the whiskey industry has about African-American distillers on record. And, you know, it goes all the way back to the 1800s, and he's claimed to have invented the Lincoln County process, which is that charcoal mellow process that Tennessee whiskey uses. But a lot of that momentum really started with Fawn Weaver, who actually owns the Uncle Nearest whiskey brand. And when she started uncovering the story of Uncle Nearest, you know, obviously it caught the eyes of Brown-Forman, who owns Jack Daniels. And so they've kind of been walking hand in hand and kind of uncovering the story of Nearest Green. And so now that you've got the Nearest Green story being told, now a lot of the brands are starting to dive into their own histories of whatever they have in the archives, and trying to uncover as much as we can about the contributions of African-Americans in the bourbon industry.
That's interesting. So it's just kind of sparked this race back through history to pull out a lot of what had been erased or ignored.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, there's other things, too, that a lot of people don't realize. There's another lady. Her name is Elmer Lucy Allen, who actually lives in Louisville, Kentucky. She was actually the first black chemist at Brown-Forman in 1966. Huh. You know, she's 90 years old now. And every year for Black History Month, she always gets recognized a ton of for the work that she does. But you think back to that in 1966, she was the first black chemist at Brown-Forman. And so her history, trying to understand what she went through to get to where she became a chemist at Brown-Forman, is awesome. And so we want to be able to uncover those kinds of stories. And then we also want to create more Elmer Lucy Allens, more Freddie Johnsons, and more Nearest Greens for the future.
Are efforts now being made to develop a pipeline for diverse talent to enter the industry?
I think, yeah, you're starting to see that now. So, I mean, especially from a female perspective, you've got a handful of women that are now in really good positions within the bourbon industry. I think of Jane Bowie at Maker's Mark, Hannah Lowen at New Riff, Victoria Beam Suntory, Elizabeth McCall, who's the assistant master distiller at Woodford Reserve, Joyce Nethery, who's the owner and master distiller at Jephthah Creed in Shelbyville. There's just a lot of great things that you're seeing coming out of the industry. There's also Britt, who's at Willett Distillery, also is another name that comes to mind. So you're seeing some females now getting into these leadership roles. And then now you've got here in Lexington, you've got Sean and Tia Edwards, who are going to open Fresh Bourbon Distilling, and they're going to be the first African-Americans to make bourbon here in Kentucky that weren't enslaved. And so they've got a product out called Fresh Bourbon. And so that's happening. There's also a distillery in Louisville called Bro Brothers that Victor Yarbrough and two of his brothers have a distillery there in the west end of Louisville. So you're starting to see African-Americans and women get in these positions to either create their own bourbon or also get on the production side of these brands. And then they're in leadership roles and decision-making roles. And as long as they're there, that's when you're really going to start seeing the change happen in the industry that needs to be made.
Well, Gaytham, what would you say has been the most impressive, most important thing that you've learned from what you've observed as the industry has awakened to this issue?
You know, the most important thing that I've learned is, like, I think about, you know, whiskey consumption. And so for years, you know, it's always white males make up about 78% of all bourbon drinkers. But since 2013, you know, African Americans have grown to about 22% of that. Asians is up 36%. Women represent now about 30% of whiskey drinkers, up from about 50% in the 90s. And so you're starting to see all of these different groups, racial groups and gender groups, really start to embrace bourbon. But now, because they're embracing it, they want a product that's marketed and sold to them that shows them. And so you're starting to see these affinity groups that are popping up. So you've got Whiskey Chicks, which is geared around women and bourbon. You've got Bourbon Women, which is around women and bourbon. You've got the Kentucky Black Bourbon Guild, which is founded here in Lexington. You've got another group called Kobe, which was founded in Louisville. Those are all affinity groups that are really focusing on African Americans and also females in the bourbon industry. And so what they're trying to do is educate those groups across the country and in the respective cities about our contributions, and then trying to bring more people into the fold.
Gaytham Borden, Vice President, Marketing at Visit Lex, and on a panel discussing diversity, equity, and inclusion in the Kentucky bourbon industry. Thank you, Gaytham.
Thank you for your time today, Tom.
We hear so much these days about distance learning. It really burst into our lives about a year ago when the pandemic began shutting down schools. But it's really not a new thing. And in fact, Appalachia has a big role to play in the history of using technology to connect the rural and isolated to a good education. In the latest in our series drawn from the pages of the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society, Register editor Stephanie Lang looks into that history with Carson Benn.
Carson Benn is a doctoral candidate in history at the University of Kentucky. His dissertation examines public television initiatives in Kentucky, North Carolina, and the Appalachian region. And most recently, he is an author for a special issue of the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society, Beyond the War on Poverty, Appalachia Post-1970. You bring to that issue a very interesting article on distance education, which, I mean, if you think about today, everybody's doing distance education because of the pandemic. But, you know, you're looking at some of these early satellite and television initiatives. I think one of the most surprising things that people will learn from your research is the fact that the Learning Channel, TLC, that we all know today for shows like 90 Day Fiancé and Dr. Pimple Popper, actually started off as the Appalachian Educational Satellite Project. I can tell you that, you know, when I've told people about this, they have certainly been very surprised. But before we jump into that particular thing, set the stage. We know how distance or virtual education works today. Set the stage for this particular time period. What did distance education look like in the 1970s and 1980s? And how was education changing then to meet the times as new mediums like television came into play?
Sure. Well, distance education has been in conversation for well over, I'd say, 150 years. There have been lots of efforts people have had in trying to extend the resources of schools, higher education, or public schools beyond typical or conventional campuses and trying to reach out to people. This is stuff like the Extension Services or the land-grant universities were very focused on this. But with radio and television, this really rejuvenated that conversation as people had these new technological media and they're trying to, and they think that these are going to be perfect to really share the resources and get a lot more people involved in education and overcoming distance barriers in ways that we hadn't seen before. And there was a lot of changes over the course of the 50s and 60s over exactly what we should do with educational television specifically. Should it be more distance education that people can access in their home? Or some people thought that it should be primarily used as a classroom resource. But back and forth on exactly what they needed to do. But even into the 1970s and 80s, there was still a general belief that televised media could do a lot to improve schools in regions that were struggling and also to share the best teaching resources with schools that might not have access to them otherwise.
I mentioned the Learning Channel a minute ago, but the Appalachian Educational Satellite Project and what it eventually became, the Appalachian Community Service Network, were some of these early pioneering programs for distance education. Why were these created and targeted at Appalachia?
There's a lot of stuff that the ARC was doing, the Appalachian Regional Commission Towards Education, that I think hasn't really gotten as much notice. And earlier on in the mid-60s, they had conversations about what they might do with regular broadcast television, but that didn't really get off the ground. But once cable and satellite technology rolled around, they sort of took up the issue again and really tried to find ways this new technology could reach out to communities that were need or that wanted to have better connection to educational resources outside the region. So the satellite project was made possible by what was called an applications technology satellite that was in use in Appalachia. It was a NASA satellite, and it arranged for seminar classes and more continuing education, those types of courses. But it allowed live interaction between, say, a classroom in a high school in Southwest Virginia and a coordinating center at the University of Kentucky. Eventually, the satellite that NASA had lent to this program, they decided they didn't want to maintain it anymore. So they readapted the program into the Appalachian Community Service Network, which was a cable network. So they lost that interactive capability that they had with the satellite, but they were still able to broadcast courses to cable subscribers. And anybody could get the Appalachian Community Service Network. It was right up there competing with ESPN and HBO. But so a lot of people learned, I guess, about Appalachian struggles that way.
Talk a little bit more about the types of programs that were offered by the network and why these particular public education initiatives are important.
Well, as I said, the satellite programs were more aimed at continuing education and graduate programs. So most publicly used by teachers in local schools as sort of an in-service mechanism so that they could sort of learn new instructional techniques. But eventually they thought they were going to expand that to all sorts of ages and higher education and primary and secondary education. The Appalachian Community Service Network, to fill the hours of a regular cable broadcast schedule, used a lot of courses that were produced by other public television or education institutions, but a lot of area institutions. So Morehead State was one of them. A continuing education service center in Tennessee produced a lot of these courses that were available at a regular schedule throughout the week.
The time period that you're covering is, you know, it's post-1970, but, you know, you still have the shadow of the war on poverty that painted the region as overwhelmingly poor, white, certainly, and isolated. So how do you think these public education programs dispel some of these stereotypes, and why is this important, that this cutting-edge technology is in use by educators and students in Appalachia?
But I think a lot of people were thinking when they saw those very common television news documentary or news pieces about Appalachia during the war on poverty and just depicting these really ramshackle environments, not a lot of economic opportunity. They didn't feature education as much, and I think that led a lot of people to just assume that educational prospects were bad and schools weren't performing very well, maybe not the best teachers or administrators in the region. But I think with my project and others, if you look at this era, I think you really see that there's a lot of educators and teachers who are really dedicated to the region. They recognize that their schools and their communities are disadvantaged, but they're dedicated to improving them. And they also have a lot of innovative solutions that maybe other parts of the country haven't realized.
The Appalachian Community Service Network lasted until, I believe, the 1980s, maybe early 1990s. What were some of the difficulties the network faced in terms of funding and support?
Well, I'm sure people that listen to public media will know the sort of struggles that are common to all sources of public media, that they always expected to be self-sustaining, and the Appalachian Community Service Network, even though it was a cable network, was still sort of subject to that same problem. They started off on a very generous grant from the ARC and other sources, but it was just sort of predicated on the assumption that these courses that they were offering would have some subscriber fees, that would sort of pay for the operations of a nonprofit cable network. Even within that, the people in charge of the network knew that they were facing some difficulties and had to sort of sell their own wares, but they were also still dedicated to finding ways to make their programming free and accessible, especially to people in distressed counties within the Appalachian region and just the region generally. There was also, particularly in 1980, as the Reagan administration was elected, they were not very favorable towards the Appalachian Regional Commission and almost dissolved that agency entirely. And the governors of the ARC, the various states who were involved, managed to keep the program afloat, but the new budget, severely reduced, did not have any provisions for the Appalachian Community Service Network. So it had adopted the name The Learning Channel before it left its status as a federally funded network, but
after they lost their budget contribution from the ARC, they had to sell off their status as a nonprofit network and became just the Learning Channel and a commercially operated network.
To sort of wrap up of some of this, what do you think is the lasting legacy and impact of the Appalachian Community Service Network? How do you think lessons from that impact, you know, the way we look at and think about virtual learning and distance learning today?
The way I've been thinking about it is that teachers and scholars who are really interested in education, there's always been a very strong sense of suspicion towards new technology. And rightfully so, because they want to know if, as new technology comes out, first of all, is it really necessary? Does it actually facilitate education in the same way as conventional classroom environments? And is it something that might possibly be used to, say, replace teachers or sort of overthrow the existing order in a way that would be unfair for students and unfair for the educators that are working in the schools? The Appalachian Community Service Network is the use of a new technology, but I think it's one that we can appreciate mainly for the people that were behind it and possibly learn a lesson that as we receive or are forced to use, maybe in some instances, new technology, we just remain dedicated and thoughtful to the people that we're helping, always attentive to local needs as opposed to national trends and the latest trends in education, always forming partnerships between agencies and between the local and, say, the university level and the federal level, and always just keep focusing on access. A lot of what I've heard about broadband access in communities, say, in Eastern Kentucky right now that aren't receiving equitable internet access and have been struggling, that was always in the fore of the minds of the people that are working in the Appalachian Community Service Network. They wanted to make sure that everybody could access this and for as long as the program was in operation.
Your research gives us some very interesting historical perspective as we think about technology and the development of new technologies and how we learn things today. Living in a virtual world now, I mean, you are connected in many different ways to people all over the world. So thank you very much, Carson.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Stephanie Lang interviews are presented in partnership with the Kentucky Historical Society. You can learn more online at history.ky.gov. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Wendy Barnett our producer, Neil Kesterson our producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest a topic or an interview? You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.